Okay, now it is my pleasure to introduce our keynote speaker, Lawrence Lessig. Larry is a professor of law at the Stanford Law School, and he's founder of the school's Center for Internet and Society. And he's considered one of the nation's leading scholars of law and cyberspace. Before coming to Stanford, he was the Berkman Professor of Law at Harvard Law School, professor at the University of Chicago Law School, and many other honors. He was listed among the visionaries on Business Week's roundup of the 25 most influential people in electronic business. He's written several books. And today, he's speaking to us on the Internet's coming silent spring. Larry?
So, four stories. In 1934, this man, Edwin Armstrong, broadcast an organ recital from the Empire State Building to a receiver in Long Island. He actually did it twice. He did it once using AM radio technology and once using FM radio technology, and he proved in this broadcast the superiority of his new technology. Superior because less static, because higher fidelity, superior because it could breach the ionosphere. This technology was an enemy to certain existing corporations, including ones he had intimate connection to, one in particular, RCA. RCA looked at this new technology, this superior radio technology, and one of the executives said, "I thought Armstrong would invent some kind of filter to remove static from our AM radio. I didn't think he'd start a revolution, start up a whole damn new industry to compete with RCA." And so RCA launched a campaign against Armstrong's technology. They first went to the FCC and got the FCC to implement lots of new limitations on the opportunity for Armstrong to spread his technology. And though Armstrong himself had six patents, the true secret of patents was revealed to Armstrong as RCA spent 6 years litigating against Armstrong about his patents. 1954, Armstrong had had enough. He wanted to settle the case. He asked RCA for $2.5 million. RCA offered $200,000. That wasn't enough to pay his lawyers. Armstrong asked his wife for some of the money to pay his lawyers. His wife refused him. In an act, a fit of frustration, he hit his wife. She ran away. Armstrong jumped off a building, killed himself. FM radio was not allowed. Second story. 1964, this man, Paul Baran, developed a technology while working at RAND. RAND was working for the Department of Defense. This technology is a technology we'd eventually call something like packet switching. It was a technology to make the world safe for nuclear war. The Defense Department loved this technology. They took it to their dominant network provider of the time, a company called AT&T. Said to AT&T, "What do you think of this technology?" AT&T had two responses. First, it will never possibly work. Second, if it does work, we are, quote, damned if we will allow the creation of a competitor to ourselves. Allow. The internet was not allowed. Third story. Here's a really cute little dog, pretty expensive, but a production of the Sony Corporation, a puppy called the Aibo Pet. The Aibo Pet is a dog which is able to act and follow and learn, depending upon the sophistication of the technology. It's a way to produce a virtual pet, a little less smelly, a little bit more expensive, perhaps. This virtual pad excited lots of excitement about the technology Sony had produced, and lots of fans hovered around this technology. One set up this site, iBoPet.com. iBoPet.com had lots of information about the Sony iBo dog. This site also included some information about how to hack the code in the dog to teach the dog to dance jazz. Now, when I talk around the world, I have to remind the world, and maybe you too, it's not a crime in the United States to dance jazz. There are some jurisdictions where it's a little bit dicey, but in general, jazz is a permitted technology in the United States. So when they took this dog and taught it to dance jazz, this was thought to be a great act of creativity. They received a letter, however, when posting this on the site. Your site contains information providing the means to circumvent iBo Wear's copy protection protocol, constituting a violation of the anti-circumvention provisions of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Hacking the code to teach the dog to dance jazz was not allowed. It's a crime in the United States to free the dog to dance, finally. You know these men. They're the Brothers Grimm. You know them because they wrote fairy tales, which most of you probably think, as I did until I actually went to read them, are these wonderful stories you should read to your children. They are not. These are extraordinarily bloody, moralistic accounts that no child should ever read. They're awful, awful stories. But you think they're great because another company took these stories and retold them in a way that crafts your memory of growing up, the Disney Corporation. The Disney Corporation took these stories and retold them in this wonderful, creative way because the stories lived in an intellectual commons. They lived in a place where they were free to be taken. They lived in a place where you didn't need the permission of a lawyer. A lawyer-free zone, that's what the commons is, and a lawyer-free zone is an extraordinary encouragement to innovation and creativity. Now, this work that Disney took was free to take because the Constitution of the United States says copyrights are for, quote, limited times. And though the meaning of limited times was relatively clear to the framers, they thought it meant a short interval, and they set up a term that was 14 years, if the author lived maybe 28 years. Over time, this term has grown. 1831, it grew to 42 years, 1956 to 1909 to 56 years. Then starting in 1962, look, no hands. The copyright term has extended and extended by act of Congress. It has been extended 11 times in the last 40 years. The last of these extensions was in 1998. This was the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act, otherwise known by affectionate sorts as the Mickey Mouse Protection Act. The Mickey Mouse Protection Act, which essentially assures that work does not pass into the public domain anymore. Every time work is about to pass into the public domain, the term is extended, meaning that no one can do to Disney what Disney did to the Brothers Grimm. The mouse is not allowed. The allowed. Environments allow, societies allow. Here's the thing the world has got to learn. Architectures allow. Architectures. Societies and environments and architectures can forbid, but the thing the world has got to learn is that architectures allow. The architectures you built allow. Freedom, get built into an architecture. Here's the thing, I've got to shake the students I teach to understand. It's not just law that builds freedom. It's architectures that build freedom. Here's the argument. The internet is an architecture. It's an architecture that allows. It allows creativity and innovation because of its design, because of a particular design, as Salter, Clark, and Reed described it, of end to end. End to end is an architecture that says, build the network so that the network is simple and the intelligence is placed at the edge or the ends, simple networks, smart applications. This means a network where, rather than in Oliver Twist-like way, innovators forced to say to AT&T-like companies, Mother, may I, please, I have a new idea how to use the technology and perhaps it will be allowed. This network says the uses and innovations that are permitted on this architecture are just the ones people want. Everything is allowed as far as the network is concerned because the network has no power to discriminate against ideas it doesn't like. End-to-end is an architecture. Architecture allows. To allow has consequences. Compare the architecture of AT&T, and by this I just mean an architecture where permission is not built into the design versus the architecture of something like end-to-end. First of all, the number of innovators. Under the AT&T-like network, the number of innovators equals the number of owners of the network, those who will permit and decide which innovations are permitted based on which benefit the business model of the network owner. The number of innovators on an end-to-end network is the number of people connected to the network, the number of people who would develop for this network according to their vision about where the network should go. This is the difference in the design. It's an architecture that allows. The difference also in kinds of innovation. AT&T develops innovations that benefit the network owners. If you have an idea that benefits the owner, it will be encouraged. If you don't, it will be quashed. End-to-end network just allows the innovation of technologies that the people using the network want. Now, these innovations have a particular character. It's not often noticed what this character is. Kahn and Cerf, two people who participate in the development of the original protocols here, these people, when they develop it, are just kids, right? Graduate students, like most of the, or half of the papers presented here, kids. The World Wide Web, HTML, HTTP, a set of protocols developed by people in Switzerland working at a CERN research lab, not Prodigy, not AT&T. ICQ, a peer-to-peer messaging technology developed by an Israeli kid, taken by his father, turned into a $400 million company sold to AOL. HTML, mail, Hotmail, developed by an Indian immigrant, sold for $400 million, seems to be the magic number, it wouldn't be bad, to Microsoft. Kids and non-Americans, key innovation for the internet. This is not an accident of the internet's design, right? It is because the network embeds the right for outsiders to develop for the network. It's because it embeds the design that says the network owner can't control its innovation that it encourages this innovation from those who are not part of the network by outsiders. It maximizes the number of people who can create for this network and therefore keeps the network as broadly open to creativity as it could be, not the network owners, because of its design. This architecture has consequences. Consequences about what is allowed. This architecture, as EFF's co-founder Mitch Kaper put it, has a politics, it builds a policy. This code is a certain kind of law. Or think of a second example. Right now, in the core of battle in Washington, Spectrum in the United States is a regulated space. Since the sinking of the Titanic, there has been in the United States a government agency designed to regulate who gets to use what the FCC determines allowed use of spectrum. Now, for a long time, this government regulation of the use of spectrum has been criticized by those who say, look, free resources should not be controlled by the government. Instead, what we should do, as Ronald Coase said in the early 1950s, is free those resources, but by free, Coase meant property. Sell them. Auction the spectrum. And so this revolution in spectrum allocation has been progressing, and with the Reagan administration, it took off as an ideal, and now we have increased auctioning of spectrum. Auctioning of spectrum, which though the law says this is not property, the lawyers say this is property, spectrum owned by spectrum owners. The assumption behind both the FCC allocated spectrum and the spectrum controlled by property is that spectrum is a fixed resource. It's as if the amount available remains constant as the number of users increase, and as with every resource that could be fixed like this, more users mean less per user. Therefore, this is a scarce resource to be allocated among users. But technologists, of course, have increasingly questioned this feature, this assumption of the lawyers and regulators. Increasingly, people have said the capacity is a function of its architecture. Tim Shepard, in his dissertation, says we could architect this capacity to get increasing capacity as the square root of the number of users. David Reed has recently pointed to architectures that would say we could get increasing capacity as a proportion of the number of users. More users, more capacity. Now, this is not a hard thing to understand how it's possible. The basic intuition is more users means less distance between each user, means less power necessary to communicate between each user, means more capacity on the system. This is an intuitively simple thing to understand, a little bit harder to design. So long as each of these nodes functions like a receiver and transmitter, or as we might think, like a router functions, here's an architecture that could increase the access to spectrum, and it has, as people have toyed with spectrum in an exception band called the unlicensed spectrum band. People have used innovation to deploy new uses in this band in a way that has produced some of the most exciting uses of spectrum. Spectrum here is allowed. This becomes spectrum on the model of the internet. Spectrum relying upon users building on top of this commons. This is architected to allow innovation. Okay. These happy stories of a network that enabled innovation and a spectrum architecture that could, in a parallel way, enable innovation, these stories are of the past. Because the most significant development in the context of the internet in the last 3 years has been a corruption of a core feature of what this original internet was. If I could, as a lawyer, radically simplify the architecture of the network into just three layers, not seven, not 11, not even Berners-Lee, four, but just three. This story is a simple story of the physical layer corrupting the code layer and the content layer corrupting the code layer, and no one doing anything enough to resist it. This corrupting of the core happens while policymakers do nothing to stop it. In fact, they do everything to encourage it. And the question is, why? Why would this corruption occur, this compromise of an environment of innovation happen with no one stopping it? It's because we, lawyers, have defined the debate. We have framed the debate in a way that appeals simply and obviously to ordinary people's sensibility about what's right and what's proper. Here's the first framing mistake. It's their property, is the refrain. In the context, for example, of cable. Cable, of course, is a technology that enables people to get access to the internet at much faster speeds than was available over narrowband telephone wires. Narrowband telephone wires, after the breakup of AT&T, were regulated in a certain and important way to say that the providers of the telephone lines had to provide them neutrally, which meant you were free to layer on top of that network this new network called the internet without the owners of the wires saying, we don't like the internet, or we're going to charge you more if you make your telephone pretend to talk to a computer. They weren't able to do that because the law forbid them from doing that because the monopoly was a disfavored monopoly at the time the internet took off. But when the internet moves onto cable, a different regulatory regime exists, a regime that says it's their right to discriminate because it's their property. It's their property, which means they can architect it however they want, meaning they can build into their network technologies that once again get to pick and choose how the network gets used. They have the right to decide, for example, whether video streams equally to televisions and computers. This was an open question in the early deployment of broadband. Cable providers said, no, we're not going to allow this simple streaming to computers. Why? Well, when they were smart, they said things like, because of congestion. When they were honest, which is not quite the same as being smart, they said something different. Summers, head of AT&T's internet service at the time, was asked whether they would ever allow the streaming of video to computers. He said, no, we didn't spend $56 billion on a cable network to have the blood sucked from our veins, right? This is your father's AT&T. This is the same story that Baran confronted. It's a company that believes and encouraged by this ideology to believe it owns the wires, it gets to decide how the wires get deployed, and if video is inconsistent with their business model, too bad for video. This is putting policy back into the core. This is putting a power to say what's allowed back into the core. And this is the same argument that's happening now in the context of spectrum. Right? Spectrum is being sold. People say, it's my property. So when 802.11 is said to threaten this thing called digital satellite radio, the argument is, we paid for the spectrum that allows us to do satellite digital radio. And because we paid for it, it's our property. And this new technology that would come along and have interference with us, one might think this is competitive interference, not technical interference, but doesn't matter in Washington, it's the same thing. This interference should not be allowed, therefore shut down the new technology because it interferes with our property. The debate is framed in this simple way about property, and the consequence of that framing is the transformation of the architecture from this core value of end-to-end increasingly into this balkanized network where, depending on where you serve, the network might control what gets served. Here's the second framing mistake. It's just theft. In fact, most of you are encouragers of thieves. That's what you do, at least the perspective of Michael Eisner and Disney. This is how this industry makes its money, just simply to encourage corrupt theft of other people's content, right? This is the copyright wars. The second way in which the architecture is corrupted, this time from the content layer down, under the war regime, the copyright wars, what Jack Valenti calls his own terrorist war, Technologies are enabling people to just steal, and all that Washington should do is step in and stop this theft. That's all that's at stake, piracy and theft. And of course, framed like this, who could be against theft? Right, but of course, the phrase Napster equals theft is a uniquely ahistorical conception of what copyright law has always been about. Right? We need some context in the debate. Think about the birth of a technology called the piano roll, which Napsterized the sheet music business. Right? You bought one copy of sheet music, you translated it into a piano roll, you sold thousands of copies of the piano roll, you didn't pay the sheet music owner a dime. Napsterization of the sheet music business. It went to the Supreme Court, the sheet music business, saying, stop the Napsterization of our content. The Supreme Court said, tough, not our problem. It's not a copyright violation. And therefore, Congress had to enter and pass what called a compulsory license that said the piano roll industry or any mechanical reproduction can take the content and copy it in this way so long as they pay a compulsory fee, a fee set by the statute. That was a way to assure copyright owners got paid, but to guarantee the new technology could exploit the copyrighted work. The old technology did not have the right to say whether the new technology would be allowed. The same thing happened to broadcast television, right? Broadcast television was Napsterized by the cable television industry, right? This is as grotesque from the Napsterization perspective as you could be. They set up a technology. They take other people's broadcasts. They sell it to their customers. Like Napster never sold anything to anybody, but this is what cable television did. When cable television did this, the broadcast industry went to the Supreme Court twice and said, stop the Napsterization of our content. Twice the Supreme Court said, tough, not our problem. Not our problem because technically not a copyright violation. Go to Congress and get them to deal with this new technology. And 20 years after the technology is born, Congress passes a law paralleling the law they passed in the context of sheet music. This was a law to establish, again, a compulsory license to say that the new technology got access to the old content. They had to pay for it. But the old content holder did not have the power to say what innovation would be allowed. The very same year, Congress passed that statute. The United States, the American film industry, was threatened by this technology called the VCR, what Jack Valenti calls the Boston Strangler of the American film industry. Worse, it's a Japanese Boston Strangler of the American film industry. They file a lawsuit, Disney and Universal, against Sony to stop this Napsterization of the American film industry. 8 years later, 1984, the Supreme Court says, tough, tough. And in as clear as an opinion I thought they could have written, although apparently it's not clear to many, the Supreme Court established the rule to govern new technology. What the court said is, when there's a new technology that affects how copyrighted works get distributed, it's not our job to decide what the balance is between copyright and access. Not our job. We need only determine whether there is a potential for a substantial non-infringing use. Potential for a substantial non-infringing use. If there is, the technology is permitted. If there isn't, then we'll ban the technology. So with the VCR, though there were lots of uses that were plainly copyright violations, the question the court asked is, were there uses that were not? And they found two. And these two uses, the court said, was a potential for a substantial non-infringing use, and therefore the technology was allowed. It was up to Congress to restrike a balance if they want, and here Congress didn't restrike the balance at all because Congress looked around at the 30 million users of VCRs and said, these people are voters too. So the technology was permitted, and this was the rule. You fit the law to the new technology. You allow the technology to grow, and then you decide how to strike a balance with the law in light of the new technology. In each of these cases, there were those who said, this is just theft. Well, you know, in a sense, maybe that might be a way to think about it, but that's not the way the law has thought about it. The law has said, what's the balance that needs to be struck? We've changed this rule. The way courts and Congress now view this question, their question is how best to fit the technology to last century's law. What way can we make sure that the technology perfectly replicates the business model of yesterday? So, for example, the Napster case, which all of you know, led to the shutting down of the Napster server. When the Napster Corporation came back to the district court judge and said, okay, judge, fine, the Court of Appeals has said our technology is illegal, but we now have a way to guarantee that 98% of the content distributed on our server is legal, the judge said 98% is not good enough. Go back and make it 100. Now, would there have been a Xerox machine if the Xerox Corporation had to guarantee that 100% of the copies made on their machine were copyright compliant? No. Would any of these past technologies, the VCR, have been permitted if the rule had been 100% have to be copyright compliant? The answer is no. But now judges, understanding that code is law, realize they can force you to remake the code to comply with their vision of what the law should be, and guess what? It's last century's vision of what the law should be. This is animated by this rhetoric of theft, a rhetoric fueled by the Valentis of the world who say copyright is just like any other property right. And just like you don't have a free fair use right to ride in my car, I guarantee you, you don't stay away. And just like my car is not mine for a, quote, limited time, so too does Disney deserve an absolute right to control what you do with their content, not just for now, but forever. That's the reigning ideology, and this notion of theft backs up this claim. Now, the consequence of this ideology in the context of the content layer is simply to minimize competition with old ways of doing business. Each new technology has been about enabling competition. This is a response to minimize it. It's a response to guarantee that the dinosaurs control evolution for the first time in the history of American law. It is the courts and Congress who are regulating to guarantee that the most powerful industries pick what the future will be, where changes are allowed to increase the power of someone to say which innovations will be allowed. Here's the link between the two framing mistakes that I said. In both the physical layer and the content layer, the consequence of these changes is to increase the power of individuals or companies, increase the power of networks to say what innovation will be allowed, whether it's a physical network called the cable system, or it's a virtual network called the concentrated media that now calls the shots in the context of copyright. It's about what will be allowed, and the consequence is that the most concentrated media we have ever seen gets to pick which innovations are permitted, right? Here's the fact. It's hard to remember. We have never had a time in the history of free culture, ever, where a smaller number of entities have exercised more control over innovation and creativity within our culture. Never. Never has the power been as large because of the duration of copyright. Never has the scope of rights been as large in the way the scope is now expanded. And never has the right been so intimately tied to a technology that enables them to pick and choose how the content gets deployed and therefore how it gets developed? Now, in the face of this corruption, like, what do people do? What can we do? And the simple answer is we've got to reframe this debate. It can't be about property or theft. Of course, property and stopping theft are important, but that's not all that's here. And in reframing the debate, there's obvious analogies to pull directly from. For example, against it's their property, let's think a little bit about highways. Imagine Eisenhower had called up General Motors and said to General Motors, you know, we need this new interstate highway system, and, you know, we don't really want to fund it ourselves, so why don't you build the interstate highway system? And if you do, you can architect it so GM trucks run well on that highway system, but Ford trucks don't work quite as well. You can build the platform so it benefits your own and doesn't enable competitors. Of course, you can do that because it's your property. You're building it for us. We're going to get a free highway system, but we're not going to get a free highway system in the sense that Stallman would talk about free. We're going to get a highway system that benefits the owner of the system, not those who would innovate and deploy on the system. And the benefit of our existing highway system is it doesn't pick and choose winners for the highway system. It's a platform on top of which all sorts of innovation gets to be built, a neutral platform that builds innovation. And in the debate about theft, this has to be reframed. My hero is a man named Walt Disney, a man who said that I'm creating, even though he took the works of others and added something new to them. It's not about whether he stole, it's about what he produced on top of it. In fact, even the birth of Mickey Mouse was a takeoff off of a Buster Keaton film that had been produced just a couple months before. Steamboat Willie is a Buster Keaton takeoff. It wasn't theft, it was creativity, because the context enabled and allowed this sort of creativity. Because, obviously, as this culture knows, creativity always builds off of the past. And if you call that theft, you don't understand what creativity is. As if the only thing that culture learned from the internet revolution is the concept of binary, zero and one. As if we oppose Disney's extreme view of copyright, it must be because we're communists. We don't believe in copyright at all. If we say that platforms should be neutral, it must be because we don't believe in property. We think all things should be common for everybody. But the insight, the obvious point, which is our history, is that never does innovation and creativity come from either extreme. It always comes from this balance between property and access, between public and private, between these things functioning together, between the controlled and the commons, that together produce the kind of innovation that we have seen and that you produced. The controlled versus the commons is not a competition. These things work together. And this debate has been misframed because our culture now believes anyone who questions property and control must do so because they don't believe in property or any form of control. Now, this is a lecture I want to give to you, because only you can change this debate, right? Lawyers will not change this debate. People who are paid by content industries will not change this debate. People who think that freedom gets built through constitutions only will not change this debate. It's people who understand that free code, in the sense of access, free end-to-end code, built a free culture. Free in the sense that only you understand, not free in the sense of beer, right? You've heard this a million times. But free in the sense of the creativity it produced. You get this. They don't. You understand the connection between the architecture and the freedom to innovate that Armstrong and Baran wanted, the freedom to tinker that ibopet.com evinced, the freedom to Disneyfy, as my hero Walt Disney demonstrated. You understand the connection between architecture and what it allows. And for the first time in our history, we have to get people to understand how your architecture built their freedom in this extraordinarily important context. Now, we're in this place, Monterey. It reminds of a book written 2 years before Baran wrote his proposal, a book written by Rachel Carlson called The Silent Spring. Carlson had a simple message. Carlson's message was that there's an ecology which can be fundamentally undermined by small changes in the environment. It can be undermined such that it has radical unintended consequences that produce this image of the silent spring. It took a certain understanding, of science to begin to teach the world how hunters had the same interests as tree huggers in some deep sense. That there was an environment here that depended upon a balance between these two sets of interests. And once people began to see that connection, they could build a movement that limited the extremism of one type of vision, what Jamie Boyle calls the environmental movement that we need here. You, in your silence about the connection between these architectures you've built and the values they embrace, destroy the possibility for this movement. You, in your activism to tell the policymakers this is not just about theft, make possible this movement. You can teach them about how architectures are environments, about how they allow, and about what this particular architecture did. Now, I've spent too much time in DC listening to them about this stuff. If you've said something to them, they don't yet get it. And if you don't now find a way to frame this debate as Carlson did, Carlson's Silent Spring, then there will be in this industry too the same silence that will allow the same interests, the dinosaurs, to stop the innovation which your architecture enabled. I plead, as a lawyer with a guilty conscience, perhaps, as a lawyer, to teach the lawyers how the freedom that they think they produce through constitutions and contracts and laws in the Supreme Court is as much a product of what you build. Only you have the credibility to do that, and until you do, those who I produce for a living will silence the revolution you produced. Thank you very much. Thank you.